On Wednesday, 12th of December, on the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, the Catholic Church in Canada marks the day of prayer in solidarity with Indigenous people. The Canadian bishops issued a message for the day of prayer, encouraging Catholics to look to St. Kateri Tekawita, a young Mohawk woman canonized this past October in order to grow in the Beatitudes. They also reminded the faithful to pray for St. Kateri's intercession for renewal of faith in the First Nations and in all of North America. Meanwhile, the very existence of Indigenous peoples is more and more in question. One of the reasons for this is that they are the ones in the front line of vulnerability of climate change. This very fact, says Pablo Izaguirre, senior anthropologist at Biodiversity International, means that if we want to safeguard our planet, it is from them we have much to learn.
The people living at the margins, the people, for example, living around us, around the polar regions, they had been noticing climate change for the last 40 years. The decrease in the ice, the new patterns of migration of animals, you know, the reindeer. They had been noticing the thawing that had been taking place earlier and earlier every year. But nobody was listening to these people, even though they would have been providing very detailed information. The same with the people living in mountains or desert margins about the what was happening to the increasing unpredictability of climate events. So my interest now is not simply to find technological solutions, but also to find solutions where these people living at the margins can be part of the solution, and that the importance of keeping these ways of life. I like to think of these communities as early warning systems, but we didn't listen, I don't think. So I think we need to establish a dialogue where scientists and these traditional communities who have long-term knowledge can begin to share information, because right now the patterns of climate change have become so severe that even the survival of these people in the circumpolar regions, for example, or at the margins of rainforests or in deserts, is at risk.
Actually, speaking to Pablo, I soon realized he had some extremely interesting things to say. "Let's take a step back," I said. "Why don't you start by explaining exactly what it is that you do?"
As an anthropologist, I work on how people use plants, how people use their environments, and their particular adaptations to those environments. So I work, for example, with indigenous groups in high mountain areas, or in tropical rainforests, or at desert margins. In all of these environments, which appear quite difficult to survive in, and yet people have lived in these environments for thousands of years, and in many cases have maintained them in a fairly productive way, which we're seeing increasing strains and difficulties in managing these environments as the world becomes more crowded and as our knowledge about how to use our natural resources is increasingly eroded.
So you're trying to protect the ancient knowledge of these people who know how to use the diversity of their regions?
Yeah, it's a lot of this knowledge is something that's been acquired over time, over several generations. Specific knowledge about different types of plants, those that are adapted to soils, either to grow with very little rainfall. And this knowledge is, in fact, quite ancient. But I think one of the things that we don't realize is that people living in these environments have to be very flexible and very innovative as well, so that there's a lot of this exchange of information and plants in particular that has taken place. And people take new information, take new plants, and adapt them to these new and difficult environments in ways that we might not have imagined. It's very difficult, for example, to explain to someone in southern Italy, for example, that tomatoes are not indigenous to Italy, but in fact they did take tomatoes, which are originally from the New World, were domesticated by the native peoples of the Americas, and tomatoes were taken to southern Italy, and they actually acquired new traits and characteristics that are important worldwide. And similarly, other plants like barley has come to the Americas and has been adapted there. So it's not just we have to, as our starting point, protect that traditional knowledge, but also you see it as a way of adapting to new circumstances and to including new opportunities.
Pa- Pablo explained that the exchange of information, together with a profound respect for biodiversity, yields precious indications in the fight against hunger and poverty.
Why is diversity so important globally?
Precisely because the world is so varied and so different, and it's changing so quickly. Some of these changes with climate change, for example, are not really ones we would like to see. They're a result of several hundred years now, the last, say, 150 years, of a real lack of concern for the fundamental processes in nature and in the world about adaptation and the use of soil, the use of water, even what we've done to the air. So given that these changes are taking place much more rapidly than we would have considered, and in ways that we can't predict, having some diversity in our crops is very important for adapting to these future changes. Because if the world is becoming drier, where are we going to find those crops that are adapted to low rainfall? If growing seasons are going to be shorter or longer, or right now we're seeing, for example, spring is coming a month earlier than it used to. There are some varieties that mature early, some varieties of plants that mature late. And a lot of these are being, I guess, the custodians of some of these plants are these traditional societies living in environments that are marginal or that were, you know, somewhat inaccessible. So we really need to connect with these people and their knowledge and find ways to support their ways of life in these areas.
I asked Pablo to give me a few examples of how climate change has had an impact on his work.
For example, we work on a lot of the high mountain areas, which were marginal to agriculture. And for example, in those areas, which have always been difficult, climate change has aggravated some of the problems of low rainfall, for example. Now, these areas, which used to rely on snow melt for water to irrigate the crops, as these glaciers in the high mountains are being, well, they're melting away, so that this rainwater is no longer available. So people are having to shift their agricultural practices, or a lot of the things that they used to do, moving animals from the low areas to the high areas in the summer. These patterns are being changed dramatically by climate change as the seasons become shorter and shorter. And what's happening in many cases is people are losing some of their options. If you can no longer move animals to the high mountains when the grass begins to dry out on the lowlands, that really limits your possibility to keep as many animals. And these were often the insurance that they had in times of hunger and scarcity. So there's that in some of the rainforest regions, for example. As the rainforest shrinks, some of the access to many of the plants that they used as medicines, that people might have used as medicines, or the gathering of fruits, becomes more and more difficult, so that their health is often put at risk because they don't have access to modern health facilities. So the forest was really an area where they relied upon for their medicines and their well-being. A lot of the animals that they hunted, many of these are no longer available. So the drying out of forests, the shortening of growing seasons, is affecting in a disproportionate way the poor around the world. I think the more developed societies have ways of coping. But for the poor, the more you restrict in their environment, the less options that they have.
Are our governments concerned, and are they doing anything to help these people?
Well, there is a growing concern from the International Panel on Climate Change, for example. But one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is to see that some of this traditional knowledge of the people living in these difficult areas is brought into this discussion. Because it's been a scientific debate in the main, and surely some countries are making, particularly the richer countries, are making some precautions, for example, through their gene banks, developing new varieties through genetic engineering that will be drought resistant. My interest now is not simply to find technological solutions, but also to find solutions where these people living at the margins can be part of the solution, and that the importance of keeping these ways of life, because they were, in a sense, I like to think of these communities as early warning systems. They were living at the margins, you know, so they saw the spread of deserts well before, in many ways, the global scientific community was paying attention. They saw the melting of the polar ice caps. They were among the first to call our attention to it. But we didn't listen, I don't think. So I think we need to establish a dialogue where scientists and these traditional communities who have long-term knowledge can begin to share information, because right now the patterns of climate change have become so severe that even the survival of these people in the circumpolar regions, for example, or at the margins of rainforests or in deserts, is at risk. So they also need the help of scientists to be able to survive in those areas. And they have a cultural right to live where they do. This is where their culture is developed, and their particular way of life, I think, merits our respect and support.
In a way, you're giving voice to these people. Is anyone else doing that?
Yes, they do have a voice in certain organizations, such as the United Nations. They do have a voice in some negotiations, for example, on intellectual property rights and their particular rights to their traditional knowledge systems. But it's what I'd like to see much more than just recognizing their rights, is recognizing the central role that they play for all of us as a planet, as a community of people that have to survive in a world that's increasingly damaged by our own activities, that they need to be a voice in the scientific debates as well, that their information, their knowledge was ignored for so long. You know, their areas are considered marginal to agriculture or marginal to development, but in fact, they're there for a reason, because these environments provide, you know, rich ways of life that we've never considered. So I don't want to separate their way of life from the scientific knowledge and information that they can contribute, nor do I want science to ignore the plights of these people and say, well, the world is changing, it's getting hotter and it's getting drier, so people shouldn't live near the deserts and we shouldn't be living in high mountains. One of the unique attributes of our species is that we do occupy a lot of different environments. We're not constrained by biology to live because we have culture, because we have, you know, and even in many cases, the particular spiritual beliefs of people living in mountains. The mountains to them are sacred places, certain mountains, certain parts of the forest are sacred places. And these have been important ways, I think, as humanity has defined its way in the world. And I'd hate to see that diversity be diminished. At the same time, we're also diminishing the resources of our planet. I think the two have to go together.
Pablo, very clearly, is passionate about his work and nurtures a deep respect for the peoples he has learned to know. I asked him whether he's optimistic about things to come.
Well, I'm optimistic every time I work in these areas and I see the creativity of these people. You go to these areas and these communities, it's not a pessimistic point of view. They rely on a lot of their own creativity and their culture, and you still see these kinds of, you know, the inevitable optimism, I think, of the human species. And so if we look more to them and listen to them, I don't think we get such a pessimistic view, because people are incredibly able to adapt and they have a remarkable ability to be creative and find creative solutions. It's when we don't listen to people and we don't listen to their experiences that we can develop a very negative and insular and closed and negative view of our situation. And I'd like to just open this dialogue, and I'm hopeful that this dialogue is beginning, and that it's not just a question of helping these people as a type of charity, because I don't think that's what they want. They want to be heard and recognized for the creativity and the strength of their cultures and their particular systems of knowledge.